The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Now, Solicitor Miriam McGillicuddy is with us for The Legal Lowdown. Miriam, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us again this month.
Good morning, Gerry, and good morning, listeners.
We'll have to do a whole separate Legal Lowdown on the legalities of living down the back garden if you're renting with the new proposals from the government.
Yeah.
But that's for another day.
Yeah, that's it.
It'll bring new meaning to the term neighbours dispute if they're on your property.
That's it. It'll be interesting to see. Obviously, there's big changes coming down the track. There with Airbnb short-term lets and now letting in the back garden. So we'll have to watch that space.
We will. We're going to start with the queries, a number of them left over from last month. One, Miriam, says, if a house is in joint names and one dies and doesn't leave a will or any other assets, is the other person then the owner of the house?
Yes, I mean, in that situation, the other person is automatically the owner, but there does need to be a document put in place to do the transfer of ownership, exhibiting the death cert and everything like that. It doesn't happen magically, or one isn't waving a kind of a wand to make it happen automatically. There is a piece of documentation that has to be put into effect to actually show the transfer into the surviving person's name. As long as there's no other assets, there should be no need to get a grant to put a grant probate or a grant of administration intestate, as it would be if they didn't leave a will. So there should be no need for that. So hopefully fairly straightforward, but there is a small procedure to put it into effect, to put it in the other person's name. But okay, it's a simple, straightforward, cheap procedure.
Not too complicated.
It's not complicated. And it's just a form to the Talta Éireann, Form 47, explaining that the person died and asking that the property be transferred into the remaining person's sole name and exhibiting the death certificate. So that's basically what's involved, yeah.
All right, another query. A listener asks, what happens, Miriam, when a mother wants to transfer a farm to her son? Who pays the legal fees?
Yeah, an interesting one. And I suppose in the sense that usually with a transfer of assets like that, we've three taxes involved. We've the question of gift tax. Is the farm over the threshold to the son, which would be 400 to 400,000? There'd be maybe capital gains tax because the property will be assessed as of its present valuation, and the difference between that and the valuation at which the mother got it would be, there may be a capital gains tax implication. And then finally, there's stamp duty. Now, there can be a lot of savings with agricultural transfers. The stamp duty usually should be 1%. If there's the farmer, her son is under 35, there's an exemption from stamp duty that's applicable. And then with the inheritance tax, agricultural land does have the benefit of agricultural relief. And if the son qualifies for that, it means effectively that even if the farm is valued at 2 million, that he shouldn't have to pay gift tax on that. But there will be legal fees in relation to the actual deed of transfer as well. And I mean, the son is presumably getting a large and valuable farm.
Yeah.
And I mean, in all those cases, I mean, the very least one should expect is that the receiver would pay the legal fees involved. But I suppose he would have to go into it in detail to make sure what that is, because it could be a very high bill, depending on the taxes, or a very low bill. So tax advice is needed. And obviously, if it's very high, he may need to get a loan, for example, from a bank or a credit union in relation to paying those fees.
Yeah.
But the mother, like, usually the parents are older, they may be getting the old age pension, they may be getting some other social welfare. So, I mean, and it would usually be the recipient would pay the fees.
Okay. All right. One listener gets in touch as well with a query, and this is for, you know, the signing of legal documents, whatever it is, you need witnesses. Does the solicitor count as one witness?
Yeah, I think obviously if a client comes in and they're signing a contract or any other document, the solicitor would usually be witnessing their signature as a one witness person. But in there are some documents, obviously the will would require two witnesses, and there is no qualification in relation to witnesses to a will. There's actually no actual qualification required, so it's not obligatory for a solicitor to sign. Very often it might be legal secretaries or legal executives in offices that are signing as witnesses to the will. It appears also that under 18-year-olds can witness wills, but it isn't normally done as a matter of practice, because they might have to sign affidavits for court offices down the line, and it's better. I mean, as a matter of practice, we try and ensure all witnesses to wills are over 18 and that they're mentally, physically competent. And the one thing one has to look out for, because I presume from this query that the person is talking about witnesses to wills, and that the solicitor might be one of the witnesses and a legal secretary another, or legal executive another witness. But it's not obligatory that a solicitor witness the will, just in answer to the query. I suppose in relation to witnesses to wills, generally the most important thing we look out for is that a beneficiary or a spouse of a beneficiary hasn't witnessed a will, because they could lose their gift then. There's nothing to stop executors witnessing wills as long as they're not getting a benefit in the will. So there's quite strict rules around witnessing of wills, and the person who's making the will and the witnesses have to be there at the same time and all that kind of thing. It's quite detailed. But to answer her question very simply, it's not obligatory that a solicitor witness a will, because one doesn't have to have specifically any type of legal or other qualifications in relation to witnessing a will.
Okay, all right, that clears that one up. Miriam, stay with us. We're going to talk more. We've lots more queries to get to on the Legal Lowdown after we take these. Yeah, Miriam McGinnicott is with us on the line for the Legal Lowdown. And Miriam, a caller wants to leave his home to a nephew. Can you explain what percentage in inheritance tax can he be expected to pay? It's a very topical issue at the moment.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the limit there for nephews and nieces is 40,000. So they'd be paying tax at 33% above that amount. And if you take the mean value of houses, it may be 250,000-300,000. That would, or we'll say it was 240,000. He'd be paying tax then on the 200,000, which would be about 666,000. So it's a lot of money there. And the only break, I suppose, would be if the nephew was living with the uncle for 3 years before his death and kept the house for 6 years after. There is the exemption, the home exemption, as it were, that could apply to the nephew in that case. That's the only. Now, there are helps for nephew and nieces in relation to transfer of businesses, you know, favourite nephew, favourite niece relief, and business and agricultural relief, but that obviously wouldn't apply to this home in this situation.
Yeah, okay. All right, Miriam, a query in here from a listener. Could you ask Miriam if a solicitor is entitled to write to the Director of Public Prosecutions to ask if a file has been received from On Garda Síochána? I made a criminal complaint to a Garda station that I then received an email saying a file had been sent to the DPP. However, I was never invited to the Garda station for questioning, and all the documents outlining the criminal wrongdoing are in my possession. Therefore, I'm concerned as to whether the file has been sent, or, you know, what's in the file in terms of information. So I'm wondering, could I get my solicitor to write to the DPP and ask them directly if a file has been sent, or did the DPP only respond to the Gardaí?
Obviously he's fully entitled to write to the DPP in connection with the matter. They may not respond with specifics, but they may say, you know, that they have the file. You can write to both the DPP and the Gardaí on a specific form looking for a copy of your file under freedom of information as well, so that may be useful in this situation. Or just to write a letter himself to the superintendent, just outlining his concerns, because it would appear that he was a victim, and he could write to both the superintendent and CC the victim liaison officer, and I'm sure they'd get back to him to explain why, you know, the file, what had gone up in the file, and maybe it wasn't necessary in this case to take all the information that he had in his possession. So just further inquiry there, I'd say, would answer his query. A simple letter from himself to the superintendent and CCing victim liaison officer outlining his concerns.
Okay, Mary McQuarrie coming in here from a listener says, can you ask Miriam if she could explain the following situation? My dad passed away last year and the family home is left to my sister who has special needs. The family home is to be sold and my sister and I are the executors, and the proceeds of the sale of the house is to be put in trust for my sister's care. She's getting a disability allowance and we're wondering if this will affect her allowance and if there will be tax implications from it.
Yeah, that's a very interesting one. And I suppose this whole area of trust for people with disabilities will become more and more important down the line. You know, in relation to vulnerable people and with our new assisted decision making legislation. I suppose to put it simply, if it's in the deed of trust, it shouldn't be taken into account in terms of her disability allowance. In terms of the trust then, usually the taxes on the trust are 6% initial, you know, tax and then 1% per annum. But the cost of the house, and it all goes into this trust, is maybe 300,000, then the initial tax would be 6% on that and then 1% per annum thereafter. However, there is an exemption one can apply to with revenue in relation to the 6% and the 1%, where a person is permanently incapacitated. And the revenue will apply an exemption and there's a chance that they won't have to pay the 6%, the 1%, or any other taxes on the money that's put away for the sister. But I would say to them to get advice on the whole scenario, because there is the decision-making representative legislation, and it may be better for the executors here, the siblings, to actually apply to become decision-making representatives for the special needs sister, or co-decision-making representatives, because it would allow them a lot more flexibility in relation to what they want to do with the funds for the benefit of the sister and all that. So I'd look at... We're actually seeing that, you know, the old trust law and then the new decision-making law, they run in tandem, but one has to look at which is better in the situation. And the revenue are, as I say, on the revenue website, if you Google it, you'll find the material on tax applying for a tax exemption in relation to a trust for a person with a disability.
And that tax arrangement of exempting it, that's a recognition that this is being put aside for the person's care. If it wasn't being done in that way, then the cost would fall on the state.
Yeah,
so fair is fair from that point of view.
Yeah, it's discretionary trust. So it's at the discretion of the executors. And my understanding is they don't usually take that into account in terms of the disability allowance, because it's kind of paid out. It's not a regular sum every week.
Yeah.
It's paid out when the sister needs it, maybe for a car or, you know, a special needs car or something like that. It should be for something specific, or maybe an annual holiday or something like that. But in the discretionary trust that one sets up after the death, it's important that one includes the words permanent and total incapacitation. And there's a few other little pointers that one needs to cover there, but I'm sure their solicitor will deal with that in setting up the discretionary trust after the death.
Okay. Miriam, another query has come in to us here. Caller has a vulnerable neighbour who is living alone and has no relatives. The caller suspects the neighbour has been taken advantage of by a man in his circle. Is there anything that could be done for his neighbour, such as a nominated next of kin? Is that even possible, I wonder?
I suppose it is, in terms of the decision-making legislation, and maybe applying to become co-decision-maker with the person so that he won't do anything rash, you know, without the neighbours or other concerned persons say so. The first port of call would probably be the safeguarding hotline with the HSE. and maybe then to work from there with the social workers in relation to how operating best for this vulnerable neighbour. But it may be one where, again, the decision-making representation legislation might be helpful in appointing maybe the neighbour as a co-decision-maker. The advantage of that is that if the vulnerable neighbour won't kind of pay out money without the other person allowing it, so they can't.
It's a protection
for that person. Against con men, yeah, or women for that matter.
yeah. Okay, very good. Listener gets in touch, says, could you please repeat the name of the person who now owns the house, how to get it sorted out? I think this is the form for someone who has died and the other person in joint ownership. Listener wants to know. So it's a form that's filled out.
Yeah, I suppose it would be, you can get it done with the solicitor, because the solicitor or commissioner for oaths needs to witness the signature. And it's usually maybe, you know, it shouldn't cost too much through her family solicitor. Yeah. And she'll do it up for you and get you to sign it and send it off. You see, it involves a land registry application. So you're probably better off going through your family solicitor in connection with it. And it shouldn't be too much. Yeah.
Okay. A caller's brother is in a home and has money in a bank to pay for himself, but the caller can't access it as his brother is his only living relative. His brother had a house and a bit of land, but he handed it over to the caller 2 years ago. How can the money be accessed?
Yeah, that would usually be approaching the bank maybe about it. If the money is in the bank is needed for the home, there may be some way of setting up a direct debit direct to the home. Otherwise, if the money needs to be accessed for the brother's care, it would be having the brother maybe appointed similar to what we've been talking about already, a co-decision maker or decision making rep, depending on the brother's capacity, and then being able to access the money for his benefit from there. Where people are appointed co-decision makers or decision making representatives, like the vulnerable neighbour and neighbour further person and neighbour further up, and this situation where there's brother maybe looking after brother, they have to do an annual report to the decision support service if their decision making representative, to explain what was done with the money. So that's a kind of a stop against any elder abuse, as it were, and also keeps it totally above board for the person looking after the vulnerable person, that it's a safety net for them as well, that situation. Yeah.
Okay. Another listener gets in touch and says, just wondering if a son has a right to live in the family home until they get married. The house was left to another son. Is there any way of getting the son that has the right to live there out of the house? Is that a usual thing, Mary, a right to live until married rather than a right to life?
Yeah,
to live in a house.
That's very unusual. Well, I suppose it was more usual
in times gone by, probably 50, 60
years ago. That's an interesting one, and I came across something on that recently, and there may be a question of whether that clause is valid or not. But having said all that, if until they're married is struck down, then have they got a right to live there for life. Yes, that's right. So there is a case on point there, and I'll get a bit of information on it for the next day. It's an interesting one. Getting the son that has the right to live there out of the house, I suppose the only thing is to maybe matchmaking scenario if he wants to
try and move things on and speed things up.
Maybe list to Varda or something like that. But maybe Cupid's bow, as it were. But I will look at that again, because there's a specific case on that, and I'll just get a bit more info for the next day. Thank you.
And a similar one coming in on right to life in a house. Couple living together years, two grown children. The mother's name is not on the deeds. The house and farm would be left to the children. To give the mother a right to live in the house until death, any drawbacks in that? Asks John.
So the couple were living together for years, two grown children, mother's name not on deeds.
wants to leave the house and farm to the children, but wants to ensure the mother has a right to life.
Right to live in the house, yeah. Now, it depends on the age of the mother as to how much the right to live in the house is. But strictly speaking, the mother has a third legal right share in the entire property. And the mother may feel that she's not getting sufficient in a right to life to live in the house until death. So really the mother would want to be agreeable to that scenario, because if the house and farm is worth a lot and much more than her life interest, she has a right to elect to take a third share in the house and farm. So that's something to be looked into there.
She'd need
to be agreeable to that. And if she's not, then, or there might have to be some other compensation given to her from the will, and to make sure that she's agreeable to that in order to leave the house and farm to the, I presume he's leaving it to the other two grown children. So just something to be aware of there.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Miriam. Brilliant stuff as always. Thanks for answering all those queries. Lots more to get to next time you're in with us. But thanks for talking to us this month.
Thanks very much, Jerry. And thanks very much, listeners. Have a great week. Easter.
Great
Happy
stuff.
Easter, everyone.
Great stuff. Thanks. Happy Easter to you as well, Miriam. It's Miriam Begillicuddy, solicitor. And when it's for the Legal Loan, she'll be back with us on the last Tuesday of next month in April. So keep your queries coming into us for then, and she'll answer them.